Is there a conspiracy to hide alien technology in secret underground bases? Well, today we're going to find out. We're going to talk with documentary filmmaker Darcy Weir about his film The Underground, which addresses the existence of a secret underground base, or bases, and they're being used to hide the alien technology from us, the public. Darcy is an independent filmmaker from Canada, and not only did he create The Underground, he created another documentary called Crop Circles Reality, and we're going to be joined by Crop Circles expert Gary King, and to find out, where are crop circles still around? What do they mean? How do we know if they're man-made? So we have a lot to discuss today on Truth Be Told. I'm Tony Sweet with Truth Be Told. Please welcome to Truth Be Told filmmaker Darcy Weir and crop circle expert Gary King.
Hey, Tony.
Hey, how are you?
Love the round of applause, too. It was amazing.
What applause? I don't hear anything. No, I'm just kidding. We're going to bring Gary on after a bit when we get into the crop circles, but I wanted to start with the underground. That's something that is always a subject that everybody's interested in. In fact, even living in Los Angeles, you know, we've heard about there was a base off of the underground base off of Malibu. And so I was kind of curious how you came about getting this documentary underway. How did it perk your interest?
Yeah, so I actually got involved with making the Phil Schneider story and piecing together the sort of underground base story back in 2009, 2010. So it was something that I worked on a long time ago. It was the first documentary that I ever released, was the Phil Schneider story. And I included in that documentary experts or researchers that have done just incredible amounts of research over the years on underground base information, like Richard Souter. He's written 4 books.
Right.
I think the latest one was Hidden in Plain Sight. And Richard Dolan, who's an absolute rock star in terms of the factual history of UFO cover-ups and, you know, the in military industrial complex being involved in certain projects and research to do with UFOs. Cynthia Dreher, Phil Schneider's late ex-wife. And, you know, I was just I studied film. I was interested in film from the very beginning, you know, as a young boy. And when I went to university, I studied film and sociology, which you get exposed to a lot of documentaries.
Right.
And that's how I really fell in love with documentary filmmaking and figured, okay, I'm going to make my own documentaries. But I always wanted to focus on documentaries that tell stories like these, fringe theory sort of documentaries, not the mainstream information that we're constantly pummeled with. And I think this is a really fascinating story. I think underground bases is something that people don't really think about quite often.
Right.
And crop circles, for that matter, are something that people remarked about throughout history, and for a while people thought, hey, there might be some kind of extraterrestrial involvement to these, but it was only more recently, in the last 10 to 15 years, that people had just deduced that they were mostly made by man. And right. I wanted to sort of correct the history on that by doing this documentary with Gary King.
Well, the Well, the underground starts with the life and then ends, well, not ends, but it with the death of Phil Schneider. Can you kind of give us the Reader Digest version of what he claims and what I know his father worked very intense with this subject? Could you give us a rundown of what his life and then end up death happened to him?
Sure. So it was pretty unfortunate circumstances for his death. Some people say he was suicided, meaning he was murdered to look like a suicide. And some people say he just committed suicide. But we feature sort of the police reports and the autopsy reports and pictures and stuff like that in the documentary. Look, in the 90s, he became kind of a cult hero at these UFO conferences. He was traveling around lecturing about deep state sort of government projects and really the military-industrial complex. When you talk about these secret research projects and money that's being funneled out of the public taxes and going into very clandestine secret research that's happening, people suppose that if you're going to be doing this type of research, it's happening in underground bases because it's out of sight, out of sound, and it is secure, and you can house great amounts of things if you build large enough bases. You know, you can also use technology that you don't want the general public to comprehend or understand, because these things may be destabilizing to geopolitical, economic, and just sort of mental well-being to some degree. And Phil Schneider was talking about all this stuff when he did his lectures. He was taking files with him and pictures that he had inherited from his father. His father worked for the United States Navy. He was brought over under Project Paperclip post-World War II. And, you know, there's pictures of him on top of the USS Nautilus, which was the first nuclear submarine that the American Navy had built. So, you know, this is back in the 1950s, 60s. If you think about that technology and that being top right. secret, what other types of energy vehicles have they employed over the years and have never seen the light of day? But Phil Schneider's father passed. He took a lot of his documents from his father. He went on lecture tour. He spoke out about these black projects and his involvement with building an underground base at Dulles, New Mexico, and the built under the Archuleta Mesa there. Now, I think that his part of this story where he said that he got shot by an alien and he lost, right. you know, half of his hand from that and was pretty badly damaged from that incident. And then there was this kind of like battle. I think that might have been something a bit more fabricated, because you have to keep in mind that he did have some very interesting stuff. He went on lecture tour with him in the 90s. But he was a product of what was going on in the 80s and 90s. You know, we're right. looking at heroism, and he wanted to come across as something like a hero, like a James Bond, Rambo type character that was popping a extended clip into a Walter PPK and popping a bullet into the ass of some alien he just encountered underground. Right. But I think what's interesting enough and doesn't require that sort of action story is actually the material he was presenting on regarding underground bases all around the world, military spend that is coming from taxpayer money, black budget projects. You know, this is all interesting. He kind of touched on secret space, UFOs, all this type of stuff, which is interesting enough. And there's so much credibility to that stuff on its own. He just wanted to spice it up a bit, I think. And this documentary got re-released. You know, like I said, right. I started working on it back over 10 years ago, and it got released for free on YouTube and then re-released, and it's now a director's cut in 2020, at the end of 2020. And that's just my latest thoughts on his story. I think his death was very suspicious. His wife didn't think that he committed suicide. She think he was suicided, and she was kind of the one heading up the investigation, because the police had made it a kind of open shut case.
Yeah.
And you could see all the information in the documentary and make up your own mind.
Well, I think what it was interesting, you said that, you know, he kind of spiced it up, but does that help the cause? So does that make you believe what he said is true? Because he said a lot of his friends had committed suicide, had suspicious deaths, and then he ends up dying, you know, of self-strangulation. So with him spicing things up, how does that help his cause, or did it just bring more attention to his cause?
Yeah, I mean, his death was suspicious. If he committed suicide, it makes him somewhat of a martyr,
right,
to the public, if they believe that he actually was killed. But if he, I mean, we know in history, if you look at the story of, we share in the documentary, you know, Wormwood, the ex, bio warfare technology scientist in the 1960s that was thrown out of an apartment, hotel window. And people say that the CIA suicided him, but it's possible that maybe he killed himself. Regardless, he went through this complete mental change because of something he was exposed to when he was doing biowarfare research on a top secret project for the CIA. So. Which is part of the military-industrial complex. So I think there's a lot of anomalies that exist in Phil Schneider's family, the way he died. It brings attention to his cause. And I think just on its own, it's a fascinating story.
Oh, it is, for sure.
But underground bases are the absolute, you know, fascinating story, and what's really happening around our planet and underground should be looked into as much as possible, if you can actually do it.
Right. And during your research and making of this film, I mean, talking about aliens and, you know, sky people have been around for thousands of years. So I'm assuming that these underground bases, at least the UFO bases, have been there way longer than even the United States, and especially our government. Did you hear about anything that these are mostly military, or, you know, powerful, rich, private companies, or is it a mix of UFO or alien, military, and just everything under the sun?
Well, there's such a mix of stories out there. For example, people say that Los Alamos, which is a research laboratory, right, that has its own sort of underground connection, and many different types of things that are worked on there that will never see the light of day or public eye. That's actually quite close to Dulles, New Mexico. So Phil Schneider claimed that was connected by an underground sort of trainway, and that these underground facilities across the United States and some, you know, across the world are basically connected by these massive kind of Elon Musk Hyperloop type connections that can shoot you from one part of the planet to the other. And this sounds like super high science fiction type theory, but if you look at the spend that the military has had for any number of black budget projects, mm-hmm. you know, we feature in the starting of the documentary a news report that covers the accounting practices that the American military can employ when they're trying to close their books at the end of the year. And if they want to report something that they don't want on the books that cost them $70 million to build or complete, they can just say, oh, we bought 70 million loaves of bread. Right. End of story. You know what I mean? And that is filed away and no one will question them on that money spend. But if a civilian had employed that very same accounting technique, we'd be thrown in jail. We'd never see daylight again. So this story kind of highlights what could be possible and what the American military-industrial complex very well could be responsible for doing. And we do have, you know, all kinds of historical reference and private contractors that have worked with the military, like Rand Corporation, Bechtel, Morrison Knudsen, who apparently Phil Schneider worked for, that use subterranes and all kinds of boring type machines. The Air Force owns them too, to build tunnel systems like right. the one that's behind your head there, Tony. So, but probably even nicer than those, because right. literally a lot of these boring machines are built now to excavate material, carry out the material as it goes through a slurry pipe at the back, mm-hmm. and sometimes melt and deflagrate the side structure of the tunnel as they go, so that you can reinforce that even more. And these have been said. I mean, Richard Sauder says there's been plans to do these for the British Navy, for example. He includes those in his books, Hidden in Plain Sight, to build these type of underground structures under the ocean out in the UK. Wow. And if you're wow. talking about a possible base that's underground off the coast of Malibu, that's a perfect example of this type of what these type of excavation machines would be capable of doing, going through solid bedrock that goes under the ocean. And this keeps things completely out of sight, out of sound, and you can launch right. submarines and all kinds of things, USOs, if you want, mm-hmm. from these types of locations.
Well, I have to say, for the people that don't believe that this is possible, just from my own experience, my uncle, he worked for a company in Hutchinson, Kansas, middle of nowhere. You would never even notice it, but he worked for Underground Vaults and Storage. It's Cary Salt Mine. Like I said, most people never even heard of it, but Cary Salt Mine in Hutchinson, they would go in and they would dig out all the salt, ship it up to the surface, and then my uncle's company would come in and they would take these bays and they would make it, honestly, it looked like a city. It looked like an office building. You would never know. I actually worked there when I went to in college. I used to build shelving for it, and you would have to go down in a salt mine shaft in like an elevator, pitch black, salt falling on your head, and you'd go 650 feet under the ground. And when you got down there, there's vehicles, there's offices, there's cafe, and I was like, holy crap. So you would never know. And so for the people that don't believe that this is possible, I mean, that's just a little example of what a private company has done, let alone a military, military coming in and taking over. So, yeah, so it's definitely possible. Have you ever even heard of Underground Vaults and Storage?
I haven't, but I mean, we talk about in the documentary that mining has had the commercial mining has had the ability to go a mile deep underground, and humans can go down there. They have to decompress sometimes when they're coming up, because of the pressure as you go down and the heat and all this stuff you interact with. But that conventional technology has been available for many, many, many years now, like 30, 40 years. So, you know, if you think of the type of technology that could be employed by military contractors, that's not something that would be on the books or would be deeply classified, you know, because of the nature of the technology, then it's easy to imagine what else they can do even at lower depths than a mile.
Right.
And the types of facilities and sophistication they can put into making them look and feel as you go that deep or deeper. You know, there's even been all kinds of patents that were filed. Richard Sauter shows these too in his books, that show underground base plans to build on the lunar under the lunar surface of the moon.
Mm-hmm.
So
I'm surprised we haven't already. I'm sure there has to be something there by now, but I'm surprised we haven't made that announcement already or already built it.
I'm sure there's something going on up there for sure as well. I mean, the last manned missions happened in 1973, apparently, to the surface of the moon. But that was all just a PR exercise, in my opinion. What they actually saw and did up there will never – that will be deeply classified to this day. And anything they've done off-world that does not require the public's attention also would be done – from 1973 on, when the official Apollo missions ended.
So what do you think about, because we're notably hearing about like Area 51, Los Alamos and all this, but you would think, because we hear so much about it, it's almost like a tourist spot now. You know, they're like, oh, look over there. Yeah, Area 51. But have you heard of bases that aren't getting, or underground bases that aren't getting the recognition that they want you to stay away from? Or have you heard about any bases or areas around the world that are a lot of activity that we're just kind of not aware of?
Well, sure. You can't go anywhere close to NSA, their headquarters, and that has, you know, a modern glass and metal structure building above ground, but people have spoken about for years now there being a facility underground housing massive server farms to track our communications and you know, national security type information that's online and through the telephone all around the world. 20 stories deep underground, and then you've got Mount Weather, which has the FEMA headquarters out in Virginia, and that apparently has a deep underground facility. Look, you hear about all these mountain bases, and then you hear about desert bases, like, you know, Bob Lazar said he worked at S4, which was Groom Lake, adjacent to Area 51, right?
Right. That was one of the – I was going to ask that question from Jesse. He says, does Darcy believe Bob Lazar's story about S4 being underground, having alien technology? So,
yeah, I do. I think if you're going to – the way that his story went down seems credible. He seems like a brilliant man, and it would corroborate a lot of different evidence that's, you know, arised since his original testimony. And Area 51 is definitely a airport for exotic Air Force technology that they're testing out, like, you know, Delta crafts, right. Thunderbird stuff in the 60s, and Blackbird rather, and, you know, the V-shaped, vector-shaped crafts that everybody have said they've seen. But I'm sure Groom Lake is more, the S-4 facility would seem to be a better housing for the archive of UFOs that are not man-made, you know, off-world type vehicles.
Well, I think it's about time that we bring on our next guest. could you tell us, Darcy, about this upcoming documentary that that you've also been a part of?
Yeah, sure. So Gary King is a relatively brilliant man from the UK. He's been researching for over 20 years and walking into crop circles as they emerge every summer, spring, as the years have gone by. Mm-hmm. I think he's been into over 900 crop circles. And he's done incredible analyses on the ground. He was involved in this documentary, and some of his research was presented, Crop Circle Realities, which I just released on the 13th of March. And yeah, it's fascinating that people have concluded in the recent years that these are all man-made, but the fact is that there's certain anomalies and things that have to do with the most complex crop circles that have popped up over the years, in which Gary has been responsible for researching many of them. And they just point to some other intelligence creating them with a technology that we don't fully understand yet. We'll probably go into certain crop circles later, but I'll just let him speak for himself.
All right. Well, let's introduce Mr. One and Only Gary King. How you doing, Gary? Welcome, welcome. And what I found interesting about you, you started off in a whole different career path. You were a lawyer, and then even ran a private detective agency, and then you gave it all up to go down this journey of bringing us the latest on this phenomenon. Tell us about your journey and how you got to this point, and then we'll get into some of the interesting crop circles.
Sure. I like most people. From the age of 20, I joined a law firm in London and was trying to make my way in the world. I got married at that age, and a few years later I had my first child. And 10 years later, when I was sort of 30, I had three children and was working all the hours and got quite burnt out, actually. My marriage wasn't doing so well. So I took some time off and, you know, was going to yoga classes and Tai Chi and meditation and so on, doing all those sorts of things to try and, you know, find some peace. And I met a teacher from America who was doing a tour, and he was also going to visit the crop circles. So I asked if I could tag along, and he took me along. This was about July 1997. And when we got to Wiltshire, I lived sort of 70 miles away from Wiltshire at that time. Excuse me. When we got there that morning, there had been a fresh crop circle that had appeared the night before. We were there quite early. And so we went inside it. And when I walked in, I had a sense of something else. You know, it's one of those kind of, you know, intangible things.
Right.
Feel an atmosphere, or like we have senses to feel an atmosphere in a room. There's an atmosphere in there. and marched around with the teacher, and he was pointing out various aspects of the crop. So he'd had some years' experience, obviously, before, and he was pointing out various details to me. And I became very intrigued and wanted to know more. And he sort of set me on the right path and said, look, you know, if you're going to do this, get into the geometry. There's a couple of guys who've done some really brilliant work on the geometry, John Michel and John Martineau and Professor Michael Glickman. So I read their books and went to lectures and kept visiting the crop circles for about 10 years. And then on the 7th of July 2007, almost a 10-year anniversary of my involvement with them, I decided to do a night watch with my girlfriend and a guy who had some cameras set up. And during the evening, a big white flash of light occurred around 3:20 a.m. And about 20 minutes later, through the lens of a light-sensitive camera, we could see a 1,000-foot crop circle in front of us in the darkness, but we couldn't see it with our eyes. And that kind of launched me into, you know, TV interviews and radio interviews and lectures and tours and all that sorts of things from there. And I'm still on the journey.
Well, tell me this. Since we've had crop circles, and I think what was the earliest that you can pinpoint as in history of crop circles? Because I know, wasn't it like 1600s or something, that when they first started talking about it? But I'm assuming this has to been going on for thousands of years.
It's like trying to discover when language began, really.
You can
go in circles and you never really get to the proof of it. But the earliest documented incidences of crop circles are, as you say, in the mid 1600s. There was a copperplate engraving of a crop circle and a whole story about a guy who'd tried to hire somebody to cut his field, and then the devil came and mowed it down into a circle. There's a guy called Robert Plott from Oxford University who wrote some papers on crop circles that appeared in fields. I wrote some scripts for a TV show last year and looked into the history. One of the episodes was about the history, and I found a very old 40,000-year-old cave painting from Australia that's got various characters depicted in the scene, and above them there's what looks like a UFO, and there's also what looks like a crop circle, the type of concentric circles. So you've got a small circle in the middle and then a couple of sort of bullseye circles around them on the wall behind them. So I don't know, because 75% of cave art is geometric. They're spirals or circles or triangles or squares. So could just be a coincidence, but it certainly looks like a crop circle. It looks like the scene that's painted, that there's kind of alien and crop circle involvement.
Yeah, I've always found this fascinating because, you know, everybody is trying to debunk it. You know, oh, it's just man, you know, doing this, and, you know, they're going out there at night. I mean, I couldn't imagine that would take a long time than just an overnight scene. So what is the biggest to debunk the debunk to prove that crop circles, maybe some are made by man, but that majority are made by aliens? We don't know exactly who's making them.
Yeah, we don't know who's making them.
How do you debunk the debunk?
Well, when I lecture, I usually take the first sort of 15 minutes to present evidence which I believe raises serious doubt as to the man-made explanation. And those I give three examples of known man-made crop circles. It's only based on when we see people make crop circles and we can examine them and determine how long they took to make it, that we have a scientific comparison to what we experience when we find crop circles that have appeared overnight in sort of 4 or 5 hours of darkness. And when we look at people who make crop circles, there are three really good examples on the internet. One's from the Japanese Asahi Beer Company. A couple of years ago, they hired a team of engineers, about 40 people, professionals, to make a crop circle of their beer label. It was $1 million campaign. Quite a lot of money went into it. These engineers used GPS technology called Mazescape. It was developed in the UK. Basically sends a signal down to these rods that the surveyors are holding, And as they move around, it tells them where to stop and hammer in stakes and put ribbons and spray paint and mark out the design in the field. And then they use tractors and weed cutters to cut out the crop, which we'd normally see laid down.
Right.
So that you could see the design from above. And the interesting thing is it took these 40 experts 7 days, right, working from sunrise to sunset. They gave a very detailed account about it in the Australian news and how difficult it was, how daunting it was, as even as professionals. And so we have there an example of 40 men who are trained to do this sort of stuff on groundwork in big designs or big areas, mark out big areas for buildings, take 7 days. And when we contrast that to the exhibitions that are done, like I took part in an Ancient Aliens show some years ago, 3 guys came along. They were asked to replicate a crop circle that had been made some years before, a very small design. In 4 hours, they trampled down the canola, smashed all the flowers off of it. But from above, when you flew a drone over it, it looked like a crop circle. It was a series of crescents.
Right.
When you compared the ground, the flowers in the original, the yellow flowers of canola, none of them were damaged. There was just this sea of yellow. And when you compared that to the man-made example, this was just trashed. Canola's like celery. It's very brittle. And as soon as they were stamping it down and scraping the boards across it, it was just so obvious that that's what had happened. And there are many more examples. But basically, you're talking about time frame and condition of the laid crop. We can go into complexity of design,
right,
and,
right,
and the uneven surface on the ground and so on. There's many other factors, but those are the main two.
Well, it reminds me of the NASCAR lines. Because we can't really see what they look like until we see them from the air, which always fascinated me about the NASCAR lines and why they created crop circles in the first place. And a lot of people in the chat room, and I believe that they are, they said they're some type of a language. And how many of the crop circles that you have seen that you have deciphered, or is it, how difficult is it to decipher a crop circle?
Well, there are 5 categories of crop circles that I've determined in my research. The first one is geometric. We're used to circle is a piece of geometry, and
right,
we have squares and we have various divisions of a circle, which give us, you know, a threefold division is a triangle, a fourfold division is a square, fivefold pentagon, and so on. And then we have amalgamations of these kinds of divisions of a circle into harmonic patterns, mm-hmm, like mandalas or so on. So geometry is number one category, and it's very interesting that when you look back at the ancient Greeks and the classics, they used geometry as a tool for the pursuit of truth. They used it for philosophy and cosmology and understanding the natural order, and questions such as, why do we have 5 petals on flowers? Why do we have 5 teeth when we're born, which fall out and are replaced by 8, which forms the Fibonacci sequence, which we find in nature, and so on. So that's geometry in category number one. Number two is animals, insects, birds, dragonflies, butterflies. So there's a kind of category of nature. Number three, we have astronomical symbols. So we'll have designs of concentric circles and little circles to show where the planets are in our solar, mm-hmm, system on that very day that the crop circle appeared. We've been given several references to astronomy, which is, again, something that was very important to the ancient people. We have religious and philosophical symbols. So we have the cross of Christ, the yin-yang, the tree of life from the Kabbalah, the Jewish menorah, the wings of Horus. So it's almost like we're being asked to reflect on the symbols that humanity have created throughout the various disciplines of mysticism to try to understand forces of nature, such as the yin-yang, or use religious icons to have better morals or ethics or things like this. And then the fifth category and final category is abstract. There are completely abstract crop circles that which we scratch our head over and look at and relook at years later and still can't understand. But interestingly, the word abstract in the dictionary has part of the definition described as contact with other realities. So there may be something in that. So from those, we're able to, you know, determine if there are existing symbols like yin yang.
Right.
Or when we look at the geometry, we're able to look back and see if these geometrical designs are in some way solving mathematical problems, which the ancient people like Pythagoras and Plato and people throughout the ages have tried to wrestle with. And one of the most striking things that we found in crop circles is that they have a hidden or implicit geometry contained within them, which we found has solved mathematical problems which have never been solved in history before as accurately or using the methods that have been used by crop circles, which is, you know, an intellectual profile that's kind of way up there.
But what was that discovery? How did it help humanity? Did it help it, or did it at all?
Well, it was a way of, see, we live in a world where there are truth and lies.
Okay.
You know, if you look down the list of people who we distrust the most, they're Gallup do a poll every year, right? Since 1976. We hate politicians. We think 67% of Americans think that politicians are all liars.
Right.
There's telemarketers, car salesmen, you know, lobbyists. You know, so we're surrounded by that. We have a justice system which is supposed to be the pursuit of truth. We don't like spouses that cheat on us or lie to us. We don't like people that tell us that there's no underground bases when there might be.
Right.
So we're dealing with something which is quite profound for humanity. If we're talking about the pursuit of truth and possibly, you know, giving us some insight into humanity's real role here on the planet.
Well, this leads to a question from the chat room. Explain Oliver's Castle, the crop circle. That was a fascinating video. And Kevin wants to know, what force does he think is being used to make these circles? Because in that video, it almost looked like magic. I mean, I know it wasn't. I'm sure it was their technology, but it looked like somebody faked it. But you described how, I think, was it Disney animation or something like that? Said
tried
it would,
to do it years later. And
yeah. So tell us what you think and how they actually do this, or how do you think they do it?
Well, that raises, I tell you why this raises an interesting point for me, because your caller used the word force. And we use that word very extensively around the world, and we understand that this is how you get things done. If you think of energy, the way we use energy, we pour petrol into a piston chamber and we set fire to it, and it forces the piston down and then turns the crank and the wheels turn and the car goes. If we take two atoms and we force them together with an explosion splitting the atom, we release large amounts of energy. All of our notions of energy are to do with force. Mm-hmm. And yet the universe is 98% space.
Right.
And force only works in very, very localized areas. So I would say that we are at a kind of primitive stage of understanding energy and how to harness it in any other way than force. We force people to do our bidding. We use force, you know, interpersonally. When we see that crop laid down from Oliver's Castle, we see it done very gently, almost as if it's cooperatively. And I would say this might be some of the answers to how the ancient people moved these huge stones to build these monuments around the world. Mm-hmm. It may be that there's an older technology, which we've forgotten because we've got iPhones and so on, which works with other matter, which can manipulate matter, not in a way that we use force, but in a way where we use something that's cooperating with it. And I believe when I see the Oliver's Castle video that that's the kind of technology that we're seeing. There's a cooperation involved. But we don't think of it like that because we're so accustomed to understanding force.
Well, what I found fascinating, it wasn't just being able to press down, but the precise angles and the circles and being so precise with everything. That's what was the most impressive. It wasn't just being able to having the force to push down the plants, but to actually make it into art or whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever
yeah.
it was.
There's a, I mean, that crop circle, there's, it's sixfold, as you can see.
Right.
If you bring the picture up,
yeah,
you
bring
can
it back
see that
up
there's
so
six arms coming
it.
Off the center. So six divides a circle absolutely perfectly. If you take a compass and you open it up to any radius and draw a circle, and then keeping the compass at the same radius, if you put the point on the circumference on the outside, and then walk the compass around the circumference around the outer circle, you will exactly divide that circle by six. That's why snowflakes, hexagons fit together perfectly. So six is a number which kind of, you know, unites well together, works well together. But hidden within that design, if you draw a circle around the outer perimeter of it, and then lay a sevenfold circle, you will find that the crossover points of it's called a heptagon,
mm-hmm.
the sevenfold heptagon, the crossover points of where the lines go towards the points on the outside will exactly lay over that inner circle. So hidden within that is this heptagon. Mm-hmm. Now, sevenfold geometry is difficult because you're dividing circle by 51.1 degrees. So
right.
If you had seven people over for a pizza, no one would all get a fair slice, right?
Oh, I'd take the biggest
one. Divide a circle perfectly. So that's never been done before, right? So in that design, there was an intention not only to lay down a beautiful design of sixfold geometry, but to hide within it a sevenfold geometry for us humans to come along and scratch our heads and find.
Well, when you said the seven, it actually leads me to my next question, because I'd like to know more about it, and I'm sure other people would. The 777 event.
Sure.
Can you talk about that and explain a little bit more?
It was the tenth. It was the 10th anniversary of my sort of involvement in the crop circles. I'd gone back to university a couple of years before. I was partway through a degree in language and communication in Cardiff. It was the summer break, so I took my trailer down to Cardiff to Wiltshire. To hang out at the crop circles for the season, sort of 6 to 8 weeks. And, you know, went to the cafe, crop circle cafe every morning, hung out with people and had conversations and went off to visit new crop circles as we heard about them. And as it was approaching 7th of July, I decided I was going to do a night watch. I was going to go on top of a hill which overlooked a field which has been very prolific for having crop circles over the years. My girlfriend came with me. And when we got up there, we met up with a cameraman who I'd coincidentally met earlier that day, who was out looking for UFOs. And he had all these cameras that were attached to his van, recordings of video, and he had an image-enhancing camera on the hill with us. And we sat down with him, and he scanned the field and showed us the field in sort of, you know, darkness of grey. You know, you can see the lines of the field and so on. And we sat there. He'd been recording to video since about 11 p.m. when it's still light in British summertime at 11 p.m. You can still see that there was no crop circle in the field at that time. And then about 20 past 3 in the morning, that whilst we were chatting, there was a big white flash of light. We speculated about it for a few minutes and wondered if it was lightning or, you know, whatever it was, or if it was something extra normal, paranormal. And then about 15-20 minutes after that, he decided to open the camera viewfinder and have a little scan over the field. And when he did that, he noticed that there was a 1,000-foot crop circle consisting of 150 circles there in the darkness beneath us. He called us up to have a look. We looked through the viewfinder. We couldn't believe what we were seeing because we couldn't see it with our eyes still. And we know we would have heard people in the field. We would have seen any torches that they had. The cameras would have picked up any torches that were present in the field because they were very light sensitive. So we waited another 10 or 15 minutes before the actual sunlight started to emerge. My girlfriend and I walked down to the bottom of the field, drove down to the bottom of the field and walked in, and just looked like ants really in this huge, huge design, which went over one hill and down and up and over another one. And so when I compare that, the complexity and the size of it and three witnesses and the fact that the field was recorded all night, I compare it to the controls of watching people make them, like the 40 engineers for the Acai beer. I'm convinced for myself, at least, that there was something else that made that crop circle and certainly wasn't people under our noses doing it in the dark.
Well, just because of time, I do want to ask this one thing that Stephen Bassett talked about. He was saying that a lot of times crop circles reappear in the same spot year after year. And it made sense when he said it, you know, if they yes, they can put it in the middle of Afghanistan and in certain parts of the world, but nobody's going to see it. So do you feel like that's the reason they do appear a lot of times in the same spot? And it seems it to me, I mean, I could be completely wrong, but it seems to me that the UK gets a lot of the crop circles more than most. Is that true or no?
Yeah, the hot spot is certainly Wiltshire. It's a 1,300 square mile county in the southern England, which is farming, mostly farming community. There are thousands upon thousands upon thousands of fields which grow all kinds of crops throughout that county, in neighbouring counties too, but Wiltshire is where the crop circles appear. And I looked into the history of why, you know, because the question keeps coming up, why Wiltshire? And what I found was that historically this area was the first area to be cleared of trees for farming to begin in the British Isles. This was the area where the trees were cut, and we transitioned from being hunter-gatherers into farmers with animal and crop husbandry. And that led inexorably to us being smart enough to create a surplus of grain and wealth. And from that, the British Empire grew and then took slaves in the 1600s and grew more crops in different countries and sold those around the world and became very, very wealthy over it. And it also is an area which contains the stone circles, Avebury and Stonehenge,
right,
and
right.
Silbury Hill, which are mysteries from the old. But we've examined the geometry, the hidden geometry that's contained within those stone circles, and found that the same hidden geometry is contained within the crop circles. The implicit stuff that you don't see, you have to work it out and analyze it. And I was lucky enough to meet John Martineau and John Michel and people, Michael Glickman, who taught me this stuff. So there's a mystery of the old there, and there's a mystery of the new, and it's connected to us, humanity, and our ancestors. And I think that that's context for the whole communication.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and bring Darcy back on. I'm going to have all three on here because we're going to wrap up here in just a second. But when was this released, or when does it release?
Crop Circle Realities was released March 13th, and it's on Google Play, iTunes, Cox Cable, Verizon Fios, Dish Network, a whole bunch of different ways that people can stream this or watch it. It's right. Possible. I did want to highlight two things that I kind of learned from nice. Making this documentary. You know, in working with Jaime Maussan and working with Gary, you know, the Chilbolton crop circles that showed up, we've talked about them in the past. I've sent you some photos. Carl Sagan sent out a Arecibo probe into space to possibly communicate with the cosmic neighbors we have out there. And it had a gold disc on it that showed information about mankind. It had 10 points, and we seem to have gotten a response to that in a crop circle in 2001. And the first crop circle that showed up in this region, the Chilbolton region, came a year before that, that showed this mysterious sort of circle with all these many concentric circles emanating out of it. And you see that same design actually in the now famous Arecibo message that came back. It's at the very bottom of that message reply, and it shows that same technology, which mm-hmm. they're trying to say, we use microwave dishes to send out our signals. Anyways, it's quite interesting that Carl Sagan saw this crop glyph, saw this crop circle, but you could just call it a glyph. And he just remarked, oh, that's not real. But Gary is quite sure that this was a intelligent communication. It's a place that they've over years sent multiple messages to reaffirm a continuity of messaging. And it's quite remarkable that not a lot of people know about this Chilbolton Crop Circle or Arecibo message that was a reply.
Well, yeah, this, I mean, it's weird that at least in my area that I'm working here, I don't hear much about crop circles these days, where we used to hear about them a lot.
Last year, there was a COVID-19 crop circle that popped up.
Really?
Yeah. And it showed what looks like a, you know, virus and a sort of lab beaker and stuff like that. And it's incredible. It's every year these things are popping up. It's not like they just go away and they've disappeared. They're still coming back. And Gary's, you know, on the ground analyzing them. So it's just that it's not being reported in mainstream media. Mainstream media has ruled this out to be made by man, or ruled this out to be made by anything other than man. And they just think it's a hoax. And therefore, people have just turned their eyes away from it. But I think it's too bad.
Yeah. And last question here is, why do you think, if it is alien race that's doing this or whatever it is, why don't they just land and let us know what they need us to know instead of leaving these cryptic messages in a wheat field somewhere? Why do you think that is?
There's a couple reasons, I think. I think it's a, first of all, incredibly dangerous thing to do, to try and land on Earth without permission these days. You can look at famous UFO incidents like the Battle of LA, which happened in the 1950s, where hundreds of shells were shot at an object that decided to hover over Los Angeles, and people lost their lives because of that. If you take that type of behavior that happened and the paranoia of our military and the security that they want around the planet, and the alleged crashed UFOs that we've heard reports of throughout history, I'm sure that it's been become well aware by some of these races that it's a no-go. You just don't do that. So there's that. But then there's a continuity of messaging in these crop circles. They keep coming back to the UK to deliver these messages.
Right.
And it's a peaceful message. It's not a message saying, we're coming to take over your planet. Right. It's a message like, we're here, guys. We see you. We care about you. We're worried about you. This is where you might be going in your future if you keep behaving this way. So it's a pretty interesting thing. You know, if you have a conversation with a friend or family member and they message you on WhatsApp, then they message you later on Facebook, and then they text message you, and then they email you, you'll be like, what the heck are you doing? Just stay in one place with this message, please.
Right.
So we can have this continuity, this history that we're building. And I think that's happening with the crop circles. It's a one place that these messages keep coming back, and more and more research is being done, and data is being compiled, and it just seems to be real.
And Gary, what do you think? What is your research telling you
about
that they're trying to say? Or
I believe they're trying to help us. I mean, we have to help ourselves. See, I think I really believe that humanity truly has free will.
Right.
You know, we're losing some of it now with the pandemic and various other things that happen around the world. But we've got a taste of what free will is. We've had individualism since the 50s, and I think that's sacrosanct. I think if we didn't have free will, we wouldn't be able to destroy ourselves. You know, it's like as a child, your dad rescues you from falling in the fire, but later on, you've got to grow up and stand on your own 2 feet and not dance around the fire too close. We're dancing close to the edge as a human species in terms of many issues, and I think that there is a sense of non-involvement, not forcing us to comply, but encouraging us to reflect and think about where we've come from, and where we're going, in our present course, and if there's the tools there that have been known and forgotten from history that we could perhaps use to save ourselves. And so I think if you go to a therapist, they try to put your cards on the table.
Right.
You know, so where have you been? What made you make that decision? And what did you do after that? And why do you find you feel like this? And can you perhaps, you know, change? And you can't make a change unless you can really clearly see yourself. And a good therapist will put your cards on the table and say, this is where you've come from. And then you can make informed decisions about making different choices to maybe make a different future. Well, I believe that crop circles are like our cards on the table for humanity. They're reminding us about a time when we used geometry for totally different reasons than laying carpets in houses or building buildings. Right. We used it for philosophy and cosmology. I believe they put the religious symbols down there to remind us that, you know, these are the things you thought about with regards to the metaphysical side to life and the possibility of metaphysics. And what do you do about that? What do you think about that? What's your input about that? So to me, they're gently trying to help us to help ourselves to rethink where we've come from and where perhaps we could go in the future.
Well, we unfortunately, our time is up. And if you could tell us where to follow you guys. I know new projects are coming. Darcy, where can people check you out and find, again, where they can get watch the documentary?
Sure. People can watch any of my documentaries. They can just go to my website, www.occultjourneys.com. I have my trailers there, poster for the film. If you click on the poster, it'll take you to a site to watch the film. And descriptions on all the films. I'm on Facebook, Instagram, just as myself, Darcy Weir. If you want to connect, I'm happy to. And that's a bit about me.
All right, Gary.
I run a Facebook page called Against the Grain. It's a group. Anybody can join. We encourage all discussion, positive. We're not people who ban. I'm not someone who bans somebody for having different views. As long as respectful debate and questions are put forward, then everybody's welcome. I have a YouTube channel where I publish some of my work with videos and photography and comments and geometrical analysis, again called Against the Grain. So anybody can come and subscribe there.
Well, thank you guys so much. I really appreciate you taking the time. I'm a big fan, and I love your work. And definitely you're going to have to come back and talk more about some of your projects, because a lot of interesting stuff. And everybody in the chat room loved it. So I appreciate you guys being on the show.
Okay.
Thanks, Tony. Yeah,
of course.
Pleasure.
And guys, thank you, everybody, for tuning in. We appreciate you participating with us. We love having you join in every week on Truth Be Told. We'd love to have you participate. If you could share this show, subscribe. Also, somebody asked if we have a TikTok. We do. It's Truth Be Told Radio. But we're going to be adding more content. And please follow our new Instagram page, Truth Be Told Paranormal. And love to have you follow us. And thank you guys for tuning in every week. I'm Tony Sweet with Truth Be Told. Take care of yourselves. Bye.